Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and today I am here with Ryan Pohl, the author of Aquaman and the War Against Oceans. Ryan, thanks for being here with me today.
Rebecca, thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here to speak with you in person. We're doing this digitally, but you know, sort of in person.
So could you talk a little bit about why you wanted to, how this book came about, like why Aquaman?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I have my PhD in English, and I've always been interested in the intersection of like literature and politics. And I've been teaching. I teach at Northeastern Illinois University, which is a tremendous public university in northern Chicago. Just a lot of non-traditional students. I just started to teach more and more popular culture courses, and I also started to become a staff writer for the magazine Pop Matters. And I became more and more interested in the ways you could use or think about Pop Matters to talk about larger social and political discourses from ecology, critical race theory, gender studies, politics. So ultimately, I got interested in Aquaman almost was sort of like a fluke. And I learned so much from my students. We were talking about superheroes. And then we started like thinking about Aquaman. And all my students says like, he's the worst superhero. No one likes Aquaman. And I just started thinking about that allegorically. What does it mean that this figure who was central to the Justice League, represents the global ocean. And what does it mean that in our cultural moment, for the past few decades, he's been seen as this like figure of ridicule? And how do we think about that allegorically, but how the global oceans are treated? So I thought about a project, I didn't have faith I could do it, of using the figure of Aquaman as an icon of the global oceans and think about ecological justice, especially as it pertains to what's happened to the oceans over the course of modernity or global capitalism.
So in Aquaman has, like you said, has been a part of the Justice League. He has sort of this long history. So I'm wondering if you could kind of talk a little bit, just put Aquaman in context, but then you don't look at all of Aquaman's history. I mean, you do a little, but you're really focused on this new reboot of Aquaman and this DC reboot. So if you can kind of talk about the history of Aquaman and then where you kind of really come in and look at Aquaman.
Yeah, so one of the reasons I mostly focus on the New 52 reboot, which began in 2011, is because of this corporate initiative of DC, right? There's always been rebrands and reboots of Marvel and DC, but in 2011, DC did like the biggest reboot. They were going to reboot their entire universe. And I was interested because the executives of DC at the time said they wanted this reboot to expand their market share and to explicitly create a more diverse more modern, more engaged line of superheroes. So it's that moment I wanted to go back to. Again, I read a lot allegorically, is what does it mean to think about this moment that not just Aquaman, but Batman, Superman, everyone is being reimagined. Then how does that reimagined Aquaman, in my case, speak back to and engage with its past histories? And again, if I could just say one of the things that also I became really interested in and I knew I really wanted to focus on it is because of two also central characters in the Aquaman universe, not just Aquaman, this icon, this figure that's fighting for to create this world where the ocean and land are united. They're seen as one and not just seen as separate, right? But also Black Manta, one of the few African-American really figures in the DC universe and one of the few African-American supervillains. and this incredibly racist history in which he's represented. And I was curious in detailing in this reboot, how do you do justice to this racist history? And again, this reboot both tries to redress that racist history and reproduces some of that racial history. And the other figure I was really interested in is Mera, who's Aquaman's partner at times, and really thinking about her as this figure of ecofeminism. So I knew this was a way to think about the history of the global oceans, think about race, think about gender, thinking about capitalism. I just gave a lot of answers really specific. But again, just to sort of encapsulate, I guess, is how this moment of rebooting both tries to face and redress its past and tries to create a new future, which does link directly to the Jason Momoa movie, which maybe we'll talk about.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting. And you sort of got into, you know, how you kind of thought about and divided the book, right? Thinking about sort of the feminism, thinking about the ocean and justice and white supremacy. And also I thought it was really interesting as in the book, how you were talking really about how this idea that, you know, Aquaman, nobody does know Aquaman's sort of this joke, right? Often in popular culture, I laugh because I totally remember in, you know, everybody who, you know, wanting to dress up, nobody wants to be Aquaman, right? Like that kind of idea. But that this is similar to how we think about the oceans, right? And how we think about this vast majority of space on our planet, and we kind of ignore. So can you talk a bit about that and how you see Aquaman representing the space and how we kind of talk about oceans and these that space in our country and world?
Yeah, thank you for that. Thank you for that question. Thank you for all the questions. Yeah, right. That's how I, so I begin the book thinking about this sort of discourse and detailing all the ways in popular culture, especially in the 21st century, that Aquaman is posited as a joke and a laughingstock, right? From The Big Bang Theory to SpongeBob, Family Guy, over and over. Aquaman is a figure you laugh at that no one wants to dress up as. And again, as you articulated, I read that sort of allegorically is how we treat the oceans, right? Again, Aquaman is this explicit figure as the protector of the oceans. In the way that modernity in its dominant form is constituted by disavowing the oceans, right? We're so committed to a territorial way of framing our sense of reality and knowledge, right? So much is mediated by the nation state. But one of the narratives I track throughout the book is, right, the story of modernity is very much the story of the ocean. And as I say in the introduction, and I'm pulling from a lot of ocean scholars, right, you could say that the history of the ocean is enabled by two ships, the first being the slave ship, right? And I want to, again, really taking seriously, the ocean is the space of anti-Black racism. And the second ship being the container ship, right? So it's the story of capitalism and global capitalism, first with the story of racialized slavery, but also enabling our world of commodities. The oceans have become this like vast highway. And as many scholars of the ocean say, the ocean has become this sort of forgotten space. We don't study the oceans as much as we should, even in the humanities. Again, there are some classes that do, but we don't have enough courses thinking about, right, literature and the oceans, movies and the oceans, but how much the oceans and what happens in the oceans enables our everyday world. And conversely, the way we treat it, the oceans are dying right now. And that's the other story I'm tracing and giving this history between plastic pollution, acidification, climate change. The oceans are becoming a vast and deep graveyard, and we don't study that narrative enough. It's at the center of what's called the Anthropocene, of like the sixth great extinction. So to use Aquaman to tell all these intertwined and inextricably related stories are so important, because again, like by turning the ocean, we open up these intertwined histories that help link all these stories of racial capitalism, of ecological destruction, of capitalism's destruction of ecologies.
Right. And so you start, or one of the things you look at is this, the trench, right? And sort of the monsters and how we often think of the ocean as monsters and how we treat and how the trench and the ocean is sort of treated and looked at in Aquaman and in the series. So can you talk a little bit about the trench and that sort of narrative arc that you saw in Aquaman?
Yeah, and maybe I should say before I get into the trench, what I look at the New 52 is the three-year run that Jeff Johns was the sole author, working with three primary artists who are all Latinx, which is really important for my analysis too, Avon Reyes, Rodriguez, and Joe Prado. Totally had a moment for a moment, all from Brazil. But anyway, in this first narrative arc about the trench is – the trench, and this was in the movie Aquaman, if you remember. It's a really, James Wan filmed it, this horror movement, horror like scene of like these monsters coming to the surface and attacking. And this is how the New 52 reboot begins. In the trench, again, the allegorical significance, the name of these so-called monsters is synonymous with their home ecology. So this is the bottom of the oceans. In the trench are these deep, they're as deep as like they're like these mountains, like going the opposite way in the oceans. So already Jeff Johns has said that he wanted to create the New 52 as this ecological allegory. So anyway, so what the surface world sees as these monsters coming to attack the surface in the trench, which, as you said, Rebecca, is like seems to be participating in reproducing this trope of like the dangerous ocean, like of Jaws, right, and piranhas attacking. But what Aquaman, the figure, learns in the course of this narrative arc is that they're not monsters, but rather they're coming to the surface because their home ecology is being destroyed by human activities. So right away, the series is engaging in a type of allegorical thinking, the way that we need to take seriously the ocean and study the ocean and make connections between activities in the land and what's happening in the ocean. And I really love the first narrative arc because you see this tension, these two ways of knowing. From the surface world, you see this like kind of military industrial response that the trench have to be destroyed and shoot into the ocean and destroy everything. And Aquaman almost becomes a detective saying, no, they're a living species. They're a community. We have to think about why are they coming to the surface. And at the end of that narrative arc, there's this beautiful sort of moment. I mean, I think it's really beautiful of the human world celebrating because the trench had been ostensibly destroyed. In Aquaman's mourning, you see him sort of being traumatized, saying, sorry, like, I wish I didn't have to do this. He's like almost like he's refusing to be that sort of hero that the world, the surface world, wants him to be, and instead becoming what I want to suggest is a type of ecological hero that's thinking about holistic narratives. And even though he's forced to contain the trench, he realizes it's wrong to do it. So again, this really complex allegory that develops, that's both critiquing and making us think about the allegory of monsters. And as I develop in this chapter, this idea of labeling beings as monsters is, of course, a strategy of humans to not just think about animals, but about humans that are deemed outside the project of humanities, such as African Americans, other colonized beings. So I try to track the racialization of monsters as well in that chapter.
So we look at this ocean and we look at the trench in this way of them being this monstrous space. And so you kind of read that opening images. Could you talk a little bit about that and how you read the comic and the opening pages of the comic?
One of the methods I use in this book is following Frederick Jameson and others, following a theory of allegory. And Frederick Jameson details that complex allegories open up multiple meanings and is the most political form of reading, which he details as he calls allegoresis, not to get too technical about it. But the point is, we shouldn't always just be faithful to a text, but sometimes it's important to read allegorically that's breaking from a text. So for example, the trench begins with looking at the trench, but the text reads at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. And one of the things I do is like almost like I stay at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. The comic is interested in following the trench, but also trying to contextualize the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean as a graveyard for African bodies that were thrown overboard during the Middle Passage, right? So again, this sort of, I try to develop this reading practice is that how could we learn to politicize these comics in ways that the writer didn't intend, but that, again, just the way that we have to learn to read the oceans, we have to learn to read the different geographies within the oceans in ways that are attentive to the histories of capitalism and racism. So again, I'm putting the trench, staying at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, is a way for me to talk about theories of the Black Atlantic, the work of Glissant, looking at the poetry of Derek Walcott. And one of the things that at least I enjoyed in writing and putting it together is the unexpected directions the book goes into while focusing on these characters, but also opening up this space to allow maybe unexpected dialogues to happen between different theories.
Yeah. No, and I have to say, in some ways, it was very depressing reading parts of your book, right? Because there were, you know, like, thinking about, like, the you mentioned it earlier, but thinking about, like, waste and plastics and the ways in which we will soon have more plastic than species and animals in the ocean, right? Or living creatures in the ocean. And also the ways in which we've created laws above the water that are very different than those laws that are that play out in the water, and stopping some of the death and stopping some of the destruction we do in the oceans is not a priority.
Yeah, Rebecca, and I think that's such an important, like, thank you for bringing that up, because it was such an important point for me that, like, again, you're reading about Aquaman, but it also, I hope, becomes an accessible way to think about the history of the oceans. And again, like, even these sort of facts that, well, by 2050, the United Nations says we're going to have more plastic than fish. But to detail that history, how did we become so addicted to plastics? But in a kind of a brief, encapsulated way. So, again, I hope, like, people leave not just depressed, but thank you for that, Blair. But a depressing book. Also, sort of like a history book that people can use it to like, learn about the oceans. So, but...
It wasn't, the book was not depressing. It was, but yes, but it's hot, right? Like, you know, it, there was one point where you were talking about, get totally off track, but some of the laws that we have about net dragging, right? And how thinking, like, I never, it was like, oh, like, because you talked about what if we did net dragging above the water, right? We allow net dragging to happen, and we allow these things to happen. But if we did that above the water, what does that really mean? Like, all the species, all the animals, all everything that you're sweeping up with that you don't want, right?
And that gets away, like, how we view the oceans, right? Because the land, like, some species have, like, I guess the luck to be cute and cuddly. And fish, being reptiles, and they can't make eye contact, don't have that sort of charismatic species connotation. So this kind of the overfishing and the sort of the technologies of fishing that have developed, again, which they detail, are scary and depressing, right? And again, like, just the pollution, like, all our garbage, and not all of it, but most of it ends up in the oceans, and like the kind of fertilizers we use to treat our lawns and golf courses and our public spaces, those that runoff is leading to the oceans, creating these giant garbage patches. And like, again, that sort of, we keep the knowledge of the oceans, like, it's offshore, both literally and epistemologically. I don't know if that word came out correctly.
So we've got, right, so you see, looking at the oceans, you're looking at this sort of monsters. Do you also bring in Mira and think about feminism and think about sort of how these texts, sort of those allegories and how you read the feminist reading? And so can you talk a little bit about her, how she's not Aquawoman, right? Like, she is a real full-fledged person in and of herself, but there's also some complications and complexities in how she's presented.
Yeah, so and Chuck Johns is given credit for, and he's a very controversial figure, and maybe we will get to that. And he's very problematic around race, but he was given credit for, he made Mera, which was, again, Aquaman's intimate partner, into almost an equal, right? As part of the Justice League, she's as important as Aquaman, and you could sort of see this as like a victory for gender, right, in terms of representation. But again, thinking like about this chapter, this happened before the whole controversy with Amber Heard, right? And again, I think this book is thinking about that logic, even though Amber Heard didn't come up. But I think it was really important for me, to, at least this is sort of reading allegorically, to think about Mera as this figure of ecofeminism. And I really wanted to focus on select moments, especially in New 52, when Mera faces this world of patriarchy, which is kind of baked into the everyday. So at the beginning of the New 52, I think it's really interesting that Aquaman and Mera decide they want to disavow their relationship to the ocean, and they want to pass as human. And it's really interesting to think what that means. Like, part of it means to be human means you disavow the ocean. You want nothing to do with the ocean. And Mera agrees. And Mera's storyline, and I really focus on one issue or select issues to really foreground this, what it means to pass as human. She's thinking about it, like, at first it's a space where it's like you create your own private bubble in your home and you have this heterosexual coupling and you'll have a dog and a baby and you'll be happy. But every time she's in human public spaces, she encounters this world of patriarchy, which begins with the naming that the public discourse insists on calling her Aquaman. She says, that's not my name. It's Mara. She doesn't want to be derivative of Aquaman. But I really focus on this one issue of where Mara is just getting dog food and she sees a store employee being sexually harassed by the store manager and start to read that scene and other scenes about how the world depicted in the New 52 shows that the kingdom of humanity is a kingdom of patriarchy. And Mara, becoming a superhero, realizes that one of the monsters she's facing is this monstrous order of patriarchy. And again, I didn't get into Amber Heard just because this I finished the book before this all began, but like, I think this sort of leads perfectly into thinking about Amber Heard, because again, no matter how complex the case is, they were both victims in some ways, but the way that Amber Heard is like just villainized in public discourses and not having a voice in so many ways, this is what Mara goes through in Geoff Johns's run. So again, I really want to think about her as this allegory of ecofeminism and again, try to use her story to think about that. So many, marine biologists and people working and studying the oceans are women. There's this really interesting history, really, really briefly, especially during the Cold War, where space was gendered as this masculine space of adventure. And right, it was really this like realm of spectacle. But so many women study the ocean because it was a disavowed space again, right? So I think about the stories of Rachel Carson, Sylvia Earle. There's so many amazing women marine biologists, women that study the ocean. Which is just really incredible. And again, I think that's, again, this is something interesting to think about. This disavowed space has also become, because it's disavowed, has become a space that's more open to women studying it. So I try to at least delineate that history and get there through reading Mara as this allegory of ecofeminism.
And you kind of use this too to talk about the larger context of women in comics and women in the comics industry and kind of pushing against DC and calling out DC for their staffing or lack of women staffing. And we see this often. And so, and this continues to come up. So I appreciate that too, because it's so important to think about women. Women read comics, women create comics, women are active in this space, and it's not seen often. So could you talk a little bit about that too, and why that was important?
I keep on saying thank you for your question. Thank you for all your, in the middle of the chapter, I sort of break away from that, from the comic and reading about the sort of patriarchy that Mara faces to think about the larger patriarchy that was informing DC and Marvel, but again, focusing on New 52. And this is another reason I wanted to focus on New 52 and the way to critique the comic industries. So again, it's sort of, it's 2011, New 52 wants to reboot their entire series and they're going to have 52 issues running simultaneously, right? So many creative workers are going to be hired. And what's amazing is that of the 52 titles, only two are penned by women. And it's the same woman penning the same one. And I get into sort of the hiring practices of DC and Marvel. And again, it's not just the sexism on the page. And I do detail the visualization of women, their hypersexualization on the sort of, and I bring in all these feminist critiques. But I also try to, I make this claim that as important as representation is, it also matters as much, if not more, as who is doing the representation. And the fact that the preponderance of the editors, the preponderance of the writers are men perpetuates this sort of patriarchal stories. And I love this tension, and I detail this story, the political activism of fans, because Rebecca, as you said, a lot of girls and women are fans, right? They're fans of all genders, sexualities, races, ethnicities, but sometimes both. I think it's a problem in the sort of the dominant culture to think about comics as being a male space, which is not true. But there is the material cultural history that institutionally it's dominated by men. But especially around the New 52, this surge of girls and women critiquing the corporation and start interrupting what DC was trying to do at Comic-Cons, saying like, what about your representation? Why are there no women authors? Why are there no women artists? And there's this amazing moment that one of the editors, Don Didio, erupts at this woman that's interrupted, saying like, there are no women to hire. Name one, name one. And all these women gathered together and like listed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of women that could have been hired that DC didn't even like reach out to. And that's like the height of the sort of like that of both patriarchy, that sort of like the privilege of being of the masculine privilege of like not even to know, right? Or the sort of epistemology that makes you think I don't have need to know. But there's this, I try to make it at the center of this chapter again, you like thinking about Mara, but all these women fans who challenged DC and in some ways won that challenge. They apologized and made a more concerted effort to hire more women creators. Still a lot of patriarchy in the industry, but like this sort of, again, the sort of politics from below, which manifested itself because of fan participation and pushback on digital sites and in person, is just a tremendous, empowering story. Not so depressing. Depressing and not depressing.
We'll see. Yeah, DC keeps having to apologize right. We won't get into the latest with the Flash.
Progress is not a linear narrative, right?
Yes, but like at least we can keep pushing at him, right? And so we've talked a bit about this already, but you you go from feminism and then you go into kind of that allegory looking at Atlantis and our war with the surface world. And so we've talked a bit about that, but are there other things that you want to add to looking at the politics of this kind of war between the oceans and Atlantis and this, that, you know, these fully fledged spaces and the surface.
Yeah, just very quickly. So this is my third chapter. This is sort of the central allegory of this run, is that literally the ocean attacks the surface. And I love this allegory. This is what first like initially attracted me to really focusing on the New 52. I love this articulation. In this series, Orm is like the ruler of the ocean. It's not Arthur, Aquaman. But anyways, but Orm says like the surface world has been attacking us for centuries. They've been polluting our waters. They've done testing in the waters. They overfish. And what I love about this tension is what the citizens of the ocean recognize as a war from the surface is ignored. And I love that epistemic tension. So I try to sort of detail these different epistemologies, but also different conceptions of violence, right? Again, from the surface world, we could say what's happening in the ocean is a type of slow violence, right? It's happening slowly, that acidification is happening and plastic pollution. But as sort of as visualized and narrated in this comic from within the ocean, it's not slow violence. It's a spectacle of violence. And I'm really interested in how the artists try to play with that tension and that aesthetics between slow and spectacles of violence. And maybe just one final thing, this final allegory I'm trying to develop is that one of the projects of Atlantis, the sort of the central kingdom of Arthur, is to be recognized as a nation state because that's how humans understand justice. It's mediated through nation. So the sort of project of recognizing the ocean as a nation, which is as much rights, dignities, and respect, and the ability to declare war as any other nation. So there's some really interesting allegories, I think, happening there.
And so then you look at, and you mentioned this earlier, but I'd love to talk a bit more about that, the allegories of white supremacy. So Black Manta, the Black Atlantic, and what you're really trying to look at and do with this move and eventually getting us to Jason Momoa and what is going on with Aquaman with that.
There's this, I do think Jeff Johns is in many ways, like he's very problematic and he needs to be called out in many ways. But he's also, I think, a really a generative and interesting writer. And one of the things he does when he concludes his writing is try to create this or creates this allegory of white supremacy. So basically, is it the journey, because it's like begins with Arthur realizing he needs to be protector of the ocean. And he becomes Aquaman, and becoming Aquaman, he learns about the past of how his kingdom of Atlantis. And to be really brief, basically, he was told that the founder, of Atlan believed in an isolationist ocean and wanted nothing to do with other species. That it was isolationist. And it sounds a lot like Trump's rhetoric. But basically what he learns is that the supposedly founder of Atlantis being isolationist and contained is called The Great Lie. And I bring in Plato's Republic and thinking about The Great Lie. But basically, Atlan was really a ruler that believed in hospitality and diversity, that other species can live in Atlantis. But there was a fascist coup to overthrow him and create a new origins, being like, no, we should be contained and homogenous. So basically, Arthur learns that the history of Atlantis is the history of fascism, and that his great-great-grandfather was actually a fascist, right? So it really calls into question so much. But again, I raise this question, if Geoff Johns is aware of race and racism and white supremacy, what does he do with the figure of Black Manta? And very quickly, the history of Black Manta, in one sense, it's representation. You have an African-American supervillain that has superpowers. But again, the one issue that to me that's just so important is in the late 70s, I think it's in 1977. So for his first decade of existence, Black Manta was always like fully armored. You never saw his face. But in the seminal issue in 1977, he removes his mask and you see he's African-American. You're like, oh my God. And he said, like, that's why I'm called Black Manta. I'm African-American. And my goal is not just because I want to like defeat Aquaman because I hate Aquaman, but I'm trying to build an underwater kingdom to be the space of Black autonomy. And he becomes this figure of like, he's like a Black Marcus Garvey, or to think about the Black Panthers. I mean, it's just this amazing moment. But in that same issue, Black Manta commits what might be the worst crime in DC history. He kills Aquaman and Mera's baby. This moment of infanticide. So at this moment of political possibility, you see DC being racist. There's no other way to say it, right? That the Blackness, this moment where you think about Black Manta as a figure of Black revolution, he's also figured that Blackness becomes the figure of terror, of violence, right? So what does Geoff Johns do with that narrative of Black Manta if he's really interested in creating a modern, diverse Aquaman world? How do you redress that past and give Black Manta more interiority? And he doesn't. It's such an interesting contradiction to think about white supremacy. In one sense, the narrative is a critique of white supremacy, but Black Manta remains this like evil incarnate. And the things he does in this series are just, it just keeps on reinforcing that he has no interiority, no dimension. So again, the sort of tensions of well-meaning white liberals still perpetuating anti-Black racism. I mean, if I could say just sort of like one final thing, and we'll get to Jason Momoa. And this is where, like, I think it's really important as sort of another allegory I develop, is that the writer gets so much privilege, Geoff Johns. But what is if we privilege the artist as much as the writer, and recognizing that so many of the key artists on this are Latinx, and to read this as a Latinx text and think about how the art maybe is pushing back to some of the writing. And so much of the history of DC and Marvel is enabled because of Latino and Latina artistic creators, and trying to think about this alternative way to read comics, to really take seriously who is the writer, who is the artists, what are they doing different to push back against the writing. So you have this conflict happening at the site of creation.
So we get, right, so you're thinking about the text and the comics, and you also then bring in Jason Momoa and bring in Aquaman as DC's move into the films and movies and sort of that DC cinematic universe. And so can you talk a little bit about that Aquaman in the cinematic universe and the importance of Jason Momoa as you see him in these allegories of white supremacy and racism, and how he kind of plays and pushes against that?
So I conclude the book thinking about a lot about the movie, but also about different iterations of Aquaman since the New 52. When I'm really interested, I try to make the book, even though it's depressing, as Rebecca reminded me, and it is depressing in a lot of ways, the history of colonial capitalism and racial capitalism and patriarchy is depressing. It should be. But trying to be ending on a chapter of hope, because there's amazing cultural creators doing amazing things, and really figuring the oceans as a Black space, a brown space, a queer space, and an indigenous space. So I look at all, and a feminist space. And I look at all these other creators that since the New 52 have taken up the mantle of Aquaman to really make it this radical space. And one of the most conspicuous is James Wan's movie. And first I take seriously, what does James Wan do as a Chinese Malaysian Australian filmmaker? Geoff Johns is one of the co-writers, but so is James Wan. And I think he does a lot of interesting things. And the casting of Jason Momoa, who is proudly indigenous. Jason Momoa as a water activist, and the way he brings that to his role and his kind of what he contributed and how he crafts his performance to think about the indigeneity of the ocean. And I look at some fans. There's this, two fans in particular writing in Hawaii saying that Jason Momoa is a Hapa hero, a superhero. He's the first indigenous superhero. And they cried watching it and thinking about what's going to happen with Aquaman too. But looking at other sites, the first woman writer, I look at the first woman of Aquaman, Kelly Sue DeConnick, Brandon Thomas, who's the first African-American writer of Aquaman, who happened afterwards. You Brought Me the Ocean, this great queer iteration of Aquaman. So I look at, again, the kind of progressive developments since then and try to like use these as sort of stories that could propel us forward to, far from being Aquaman being a joke, he should be at the center of our cultural attention, right? And I think it's so telling that the Aquaman movie is the highest grossing movie in the DC cinematic universe, right? This is a moment, and I hope DC both recognizes and continues to give us more diverse in ways to think about Aquaman.
So what do you think, like, you've been worried, but you know, you say, you talk about this, like this hopeful future with Aquaman. And what do you think? Do you think the comics are going to reflect some of what you're talking about? Where do you see Aquaman headed? And if it's going to be headed, is he going to be headed in a different direction with the cinematic universe than he is in the comics?
Yeah, or? I am amazing at predicting the future, so I'm really glad you asked me this question.
Not to put you on the spot or anything, but the important
thing is just, I think, at least for myself, to remind myself, I try to remind my students, is that progress is never linear, right? There are breaks, right? And I think what's so interesting about comics as an expanded universe across multiple media is there's going to be regressive iterations. But again, those progressive ones is where we need, I think, should both celebrate and support and help disseminate. But I think Jason Momoa is really at the center of it. And again, DC, at least at their cinematic universe, there's two new people at the head. And I hope, like, and I think Jason Momoa is such a draw. And I know he's taking much more of an effort to write the second one and making it more of an environmental allegory. And I hope that continues to shape what's happening in comic books. And by the way, one of the things which we didn't get to, I think some of the most exciting developments of Aquaman is happening on the animated television show Young Justice, where Aquaman's a black queer character, right? I don't know if that's going to be renewed, but again, to recognize there's all these incredible waves, these progressive waves, both to think about how diverse the ocean is from a human perspective, again, in terms of race, gender, sexuality, ethnicity, but also to tell the ocean story. So again, popular culture is an ideological battlefield. There's going to be just to kind of, then there's a lot of readers that are really conservative and racist and sexist. And I'm sure DC is going to want to get their market share to appeal to them. But again, I hope this book could be a small drop in sort of the conversation is remembering that all our superheroes, as much as they are corporate properties, they also belong to the fans, right? And our pushback matters. And again, I just love the idea of having more diverse, having more indigenous Aquaman and African-American Aquaman and Aqua Women is created by different women figures to tell the ocean stories and to remind us what a diverse, important space it is for having a more socially just future for humans and for non-humans.
So I will ask you my final question that I always ask, because we've been talking about Aquaman in the book for a while. Is there anything either with this book or other things that you're working on? Any last plugs you want to put out there, or what you're working on right now, or anything with Aquaman and the war against oceans?
So I continue to, like, I still want to, like, follow Aquaman, and I'm not leaving it behind. But my new book project, which I'm currently working on, you know, it's been a year, but I'm really excited about it as I'm looking at the story of American soils and how the soils support different political imaginations. So trying to decenter it, both tracing how it's become this ecology of whiteness and white supremacy, but also thinking about the healthiest soils or the most diverse soils, both in terms of its biodiversity, but also its cultural diversity, and thinking about just different African-American and indigenous at Asian American stories within the soils, and what does it mean to think about the United States from the ground up, and not just from the surface, the ground up, but even further below. So I'm looking at a different ecology to tell really the story of the United States from a maybe a surprising perspective from way underground.
That being in Illinois, in a space where people talk about the soil often and the importance of the soil, that's really fascinating.
Yeah, and again, but not just the soil, like the importance of the soil for like produce and profit,
right?
For the stories that are there, and like, sorry, like, I know we were getting off, but like, we need to think about it because it's like, as soil scientists are telling us, because of our practices, our capitalist practices, we have less than 60 harvests left. We can't continue to treat the soil the way we do to have a sustainable future. And how does like studying the stories in the soil give us alternatives to having a healthier future and a healthier relationship to the past?
Well, Ryan, it's been wonderful talking to you again. Ryan Pohl, who's the author of Aquaman and the War Against Oceans. Thanks for talking with me for New Books in Popular Culture.
Rebecca, thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure.